good afternoon, you, and welcome to Monday's Richie Allen Radio Show, brought to you by Richie Allen, by myself. How are you doing? Hope you had a lovely weekend. I've got a really good week ahead for you, I think, with great guests, great topics for discussion. Reach out to the programme, use the app, use the comment live on richieallen.co.uk. It's absolutely smashing, super to be with you, so it is.
Uncensored, unfiltered, you're listening to Richie Allen on the world's most popular independent news radio show.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, a little bit later on this hour, I'll be joined by the wonderful John Waters, great Irish writer, great Irish broadcaster and author. I've invited John on the programme today to look ahead to the referenda this coming Friday in the great country from which I hail. It's very important, but I also want to talk to him about other things. Extremism being one, the definition of extremism and how it's changing, not just here in the UK, but also in the Republic of Ireland as well. Monday's programme, as I said, it promises to be a good old week. I've got to fess up. Go on, fess up, Baldy. You got to fess up. A few weeks ago, I reached out to Richard and Fred from Right Said Fred, and I said, hey lads, it's been a while since you were on, let's do a show. No problem, said the lads. Can you do Monday the 4th of March? You can see where this is going, can't you? I can, says I. I'll put it in the diary, except I didn't. I put it in Tuesday's slot, like an idiot. So about a half an hour ago, Richard says to me, we good? Fred says to me, Fred, we good for today, we are. And I said, no, we're not. What do you mean? My mistake. But do you know what they say about stars, about true stars? True stars, they never throw a diva fit, ever. They just get on with it. So the lads will be on tomorrow instead of today, and I thank them for that. My only excuse is, you know, when you do it all by yourself, I'm not looking for sympathy here now. But that's what I did. Like in Egypt, while I was speaking to him, I put it in Tuesday instead of today. So John Waters today, brilliant. And Fred and Richard tomorrow, brilliant. Fantastic. And I've got other guests booked in this week. It's going to be a good old week. So it is. So thanks to Fred for his decency, common decency. Sure, human fallibility, you know. I make mistakes just like everybody else. And there you thought I was perfect. Far from perfect. Listen, come here and I tell you. And in other news, I do like to do things ass backwards, you know. The estate of Sinead O'Connor is raging. They've asked Donald Trump's campaign to stop using her music at these political rallies. Trump has played Sinead's best known song, Nothing Compares to You. He played it in Maryland and he played it somewhere else. It was written by Prince, of course. Her estate told BBC News that it was no exaggeration to say, and that's how you know that her estate is being run by Irish people, because that's the exact statement. Now, tis no exaggeration to say that Sinead would have been disgusted, would have been hurt and insulted by his use of her music. He's running for president, and he will be the Republican nominee, won't he? And a joint statement from Sinead's estate and her long-time label Chrysalis Records said, Sinead's life was defined by a fierce moral code, honesty, kindness, fairness and decency towards her fellow human beings. I give over now, will you? We know Sinead was great, but she was a flawed human being. Nothing wrong with that. But the outrage that Donald has been using her music, no response yet from Donald's campaign team. The Guardian has reported songs, including ABBA's Dancing Queen, Johnny Cash's Ring of Fire, and Elvis's Suspicious Minds were also used by Donald Trump. The Guardian is ratting out Donald Trump. The Guardian newspaper is contacting various artists to say, hey, you won't believe it, but that crazy-haired bastard, that racist, that misogynist, he's playing your music. This is what the media has been reduced to, honestly. And then they're hoping to get some story out of it that the artist's representatives will then contact Trump's campaign to say, stop playing the music. Can you think of any other controversies? I do remember, well, I don't remember, because I was too young. I was only 10 at the time, but Ronald Reagan did use Born in the USA for his re-election campaign, didn't he, in 84. What a stupid bastard. He only had to read the lyrics of the song Born in the USA to know. but it didn't matter. He was re-elected anyway. Blair used D-Ream, Things Can Only Get Better, didn't he, in 1997. That's before he went and killed a million people in Iraq. Blair used that Things Can Only Get Better, didn't he? And they did get better for his globalist masters, but not for everybody else. Ofcom has found that Dan Wootton's interview, Dan Wootton, another grade A sleazebag, in my opinion, his interview with Lawrence Fox broke broadcasting rules, according to Ofcom. You might remember, last September, I think it was last September or October, I can't remember, comments made during the programme, Wootton was interviewing Lawrence Fox, laugh out loud, I'll give you a minute to laugh out loud, not at Lawrence at all, no, not at all, but the idea he was interviewing him. GB News doesn't do interviews. Its presenters bring on a parade of people they agree with, and they yuck it up for an hour at a time. It's rubbish broadcasting. Anyway, most of it is rubbish. Not all of it is rubbish. But during the conversation, Fox mentioned the political journalist Ava Evans and said he wouldn't shag her, which is not great, let's be honest about it. Viewers complained and said the remarks were sexist, misogynistic and offensive, and that Wootton, the presenter, didn't do enough to chastise Lawrence Fox. Ofcom have said, yeah, that's right. Which pisses me off, because it's hardly a hanging offence, is it? You know? I mean, Ofcom didn't give a shit, did it? When every prime-time national presenter told its audiences to shut up and have the jab. Remember those days? Shut up and have a jab. Get the bloody jab, James O'Brien said. Ofcom didn't give a shit. Madness. Speaking of madness, I do like to bring you Monday. This is a new slot. We've been doing it every Monday. It's the first time I've given it a name. New slot, Monday. Madness. Speaking of madness, I would like you to feast your ears. BBC News 24, this lunchtime, slavery reparations.
Now, staying in the UK, the Church of England setting up an investment fund to help repair the damage caused by historic links to slavery.
How could you do that? How could you do that? So the church thinks, the Church of England that is, which Jug Ears, by the way, old Charlie boy, he's the head of the Church of England. They reckon that they have some links to slavery going back a long time ago and they can repair it. How?
Now, they've been told the proposed £100 million
£100 million
fund is not enough.
What? Not enough?
Report by Church Commissioners Charity recommended raising the fund to £1 billion.
What?
Pounds. Let's speak now to our correspondent, Ellie Price. Hi, Ellie. Tell us where you are and what's been happening there.
Jesus, Mary and Joseph. We were going to give £100 million, says the church. Who's parishioners, by the way? What do you call them? Congregation. The flock. Most of them are starving. Can't pay their bills. About to lose their homes. Tell you what we'll do. We'll pay £100 million to repair the links that we had to slavery. Nah, it's not enough. It's got to be £1 billion. Let's hear the BBC reporter. She's standing with a black bishop in, can't think of the name of the town.
Well, I'm in Lambeth Palace now. Lovely view behind me.
Lambeth Palace.
Which I'll show you more in detail in a second. Talking about this amount of money that the church has agreed that would be a good idea to spend in terms of reparation. And also this idea that this amount of money and the payment of reparations by the Church of England could be something of a catalyst for other organisations.
Keep that in mind. It could be a catalyst for other organisations. £1 billion, imagine. The church is going to give £1 billion. Where's it going to get the billion?
Other institutions to follow suit. So let's dig into that a little bit more. I'm joined now by Bishop Rosemary Mallett, who was the chair of the, essentially the authors of this report. Talk me through this idea of why this would be a catalyst for other institutions. Do you think it could work?
This is the Bishop Rosemary Mallett who wants the church to go woke.
I'm praying that it would work because it's an amount of money that we hope is sufficient to enable us to...
She hopes £1 billion is sufficient.
Over the next 10 years, invest in black-led businesses so that,
The church is going to invest in black-led businesses.
Brings back enough money into what we feel is going to be a perpetuity fund. But it's not just about the finances. We're also going to invest in health and in education. We're going to invest in programs and projects that will trickle down into our schools. So we will learn more about the history of our country, of our church, but also not just to learn about the history, but how we can do things differently for the now and work for justice for the future. This is a fund that will
work for justice for the future.
We hope bring about healing, bring about repair, and actually work for justice.
It's mad, isn't it? It's utterly mad, this. We hope that it'll trickle down into schools so kids can learn about slavery. So just after you get out of a class where they talk to you about weird and wonderful ways of having sex and that you might be one of 150 genders, let's move into another class now where we tell you why all white people were evil back then. Mad stuff. Like I said, the congregation, starving, people losing their homes. But we'll find a billion for reparations. To be honest, if it swings round our way, by our way I mean the Irish way, this silliness, and if they offer reparations for the famine, I'll have some of that. My great-great-great-grandpappy was sent to Australia for stealing Trevelyan's corn. I'm sure of it. I'll have a few bob, if a few bob is going. It is nearly 10:30 past the hour. Have you had a jab? Do you want a jab? Do you want a jab, anyone? Measles jabs are all the rage. Last 2 weeks and this week too. There is a concerted campaign, a concerted effort to get people to look and check their measles vaccination status. Not just children. Funnily enough, older people. Have you had a measles jab in your lifetime? Maybe now's the time to have one. Have a listen to Morning Ireland in Dublin, RTE. It's good, this.
More than 300,000 people are to be offered a measles catch-up vaccine under
300,000.
Under plans drawn up by health officials. The catch-up programme is being rolled out following an increase in cases in Britain and across Europe and one death in this country, the first in more than 20 years. Following his death, the family of Pat Gorman appealed to the public to get vaccinated in order to spare another family their heartache.
What? What did the family of Pat O'Gorman do?
Following his death, the family of Pat Gorman appealed to the public to get vaccinated in order to spare another family their heartache.
Oh, Gavora Dia Uring. Pat Gorman died of measles. This is a man, not a child. How did he die of measles? I bet you Pat weighed about 29 stone. I bet you he had diabetes. I bet you he had COPD. It sounds a bit like that. And he's died and they've tested him to see what else he had, and they found measles. Because it sounds a bit mad, really, doesn't it? Anyway, one person and the family want everybody to get jabbed so that they don't suffer the same heartache. Let's hear a bit more from Morning Ireland.
We'd 4 measles cases reported last year, 2 in 2022.
I jumped the gun there. Let's hear a bit more from Morning Ireland.
The World Health Organization issued an urgent warning after what they called an alarming 30-fold rise in cases around Europe. The plan is expected to come before Cabinet tomorrow. For more, I'm joined by our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers. One case, Fergal, of measles resulting in death here in this country. How great a concern is there about the spread of the virus now?
Well,
measles is a highly infectious disease that can cause serious complications, particularly in children under 1 year of age, pregnant women. And
a child has more chance of dying from being hit by a piano dropped out of a window from a penthouse apartment than dying of the measles. If you don't believe me, put those exact words into a search engine and you'll find I'm telling you the truth. You've got such a little chance of dying from measles, it's almost ridiculous, right?
The immunosuppressed. And there has been that one confirmed case here of measles, and sadly it resulted in the death of a man in early February.
It's really unlucky that, isn't it? We had one confirmed case of measles, and that guy died. How many cases of measles do you have in Ireland? One. What happened? Guy died. So what we need to do now is vaccinate the entire country.
But also there's been that increase in cases in the UK and across Europe, about a 30-fold rise across Europe.
Wow, 30-fold rise across Europe. That could mean 30 cases across Europe, you know. Let's hear a bit more. This is interesting.
We'd 4 measles cases reported.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. Yeah, I should have set this up. He lays it out. He lays out how seriously measles has impacted the great state of the Republic of Ireland in recent years. Have a listen. I mean, listen.
We'd 4 measles cases reported last year.
4 last year.
2.
Just over 5 million people living in Ireland, by the way.
2 in 2022. No cases in 2021 and 5 cases in 2020. And
none in 2021 and 5 in 2020.
And there have been no deaths in any of those years until this year.
Until poor Mr. Gorman.
So what are the details now of this programme?
Well, it'll see...
She's an awful idiot, isn't she, the presenter? I mean, the obvious next question, even for the most inexperienced presenter is, and they want to vaccinate 300,000 people? Because we had 4 last year, and a couple of years before that we had none, and the year before that we had 1, and we had 2 last year now. 300,000 vaccines now we need to get into people.
Over 300,000 people to be offered the measles catch-up vaccine. I mean, the programme is obviously is being rolled out because of the public health threat from measles. Minister for Health Stephen Donnelly is expected to bring the plan, which is going to cost about €4.6 million.
€4.6 million.
To Cabinet on Tuesday. And the catch-up programme, it would involve an intensive campaign over 12 to 13 or so weeks, delivering vaccination to a range of groups, mainly targeted at children, young people up to the age of 24 years, healthcare workers.
Up to 24 years?
Workers, and then
healthcare workers?
Underserved populations such as travellers, Roma, people who are homeless, refugees and applicants seeking protection, and other vulnerable migrants, and also those in custodial settings. And then after that, the next priority group will be those aged 25 to 34 years.
25 to 34 years, we better get them vaccinated against measles.
And then also offering vaccination to those born after 1978. People born here before 1978 are likely to have immunity to measles.
Yeah, because they got it naturally and got over it, like most kids do. Smart stuff, this, isn't it? 300,000. They're very specific, aren't they? It's almost like somebody who works for a major pharmaceutical company who might have a direct phone line to the Irish Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly. Is that his name, Donnelly? Might have picked up the phone to him and said, Stephen, we need to get rid of 300,000 measles jabs. You know what to do, don't you? I do, of course, yeah. Jesus. And we often talk about lockstep, don't we? We talk about lockstep on this programme. Here's Kay Birdie on Sky News this morning. We are Dublin. Let's hear London.
Hello again, everybody. You're watching The Breakfast Show here on Sky News.
Hello, Kay.
Dr. Sonia is with us this morning. Talking about vaccinations. What's the problem?
So for the past 10...
We're talking about vaccinations. What's the problem? Kay says to a GP.
10 years now in this country, we've seen a steady drop in vaccination rates amongst children. And this has been really concerning us amongst in the healthcare service. And we've now dropped to the vaccine levels have dropped to such a low level in some parts of the country where we don't no longer have population levels of immunity. And there's risks that then the virus is concerned.
But you probably have herd immunity.
And spread and that we see outbreaks. We've seen that in the past few years with measles, where you're having outbreaks occurring in some parts of the country. And last week, there were over 60 cases of measles in just 1 week. And this is really, really worrying because the vaccines are really safe and they're an effective way of preventing children getting these conditions. And you know what's, I think, really frustrating and sad about something like measles is that we don't have treatment for it. So potentially children can become very unwell if they get the virus.
Potentially.
And, you know, getting children vaccinated to stop them getting that is really, really important.
It's really, really.
Really, really worrying.
Really, really worrying.
Really, really worrying.
It's really, she was absolutely fucked at birth. They gave her a lisp and an inability to pronounce her R's. It's not fair, that, is it? That's Dr. Sonia, somebody or other, pushing the measles jabs, where there's no issue with measles in this country.
I thought we said in the 90s that we'd eradicated measles.
We had eradicated measles and other conditions as well, you know, things like smallpox, polio, we've effectively eradicated due to the success of vaccination programmes. And we were measles free up until 2016 in this country, which shows again the success of the vaccination programme. But due to the fact that in recent years, more and more people are not getting their kids vaccinated. And there's some parts of the country where you have 1 in 4 children who are not fully vaccinated, then that then allows the virus to spread and outbreaks occur.
Wait for it.
Which is really, really worrying.
It's really, really worrying.
It's worrying for those children who are unvaccinated, but also worrying as well for other people in communities who can't be vaccinated because they're too young or because they have other health conditions. So it puts them at risk as well.
We're back to that again. Have the jab for those who can't have the jab, which is medically unethical, of course, isn't it? It's shocking, this. And I've said to you before, I know you don't believe me, that these interviews are scripted. Now, I know you don't believe this, and you're entitled not to believe it, but they are scripted. Here's the proof they are scripted. Listen to Kay Burley.
In a case of do as I say, not as I do, I have...
She's reading this. In a case of do as I say and not as I do, she's reading this.
In a case of do as I say, not as I do, I have not had my flu vaccine.
Yeah. Kay's not had her flu vaccine. What can we do? Wait till you hear the doctor. Yeah.
Vaccine. Yeah. I'm a bad person, yeah. I know.
You're not a bad person.
No, she is. She's fucking horrible.
And with, you know, with childhood vaccinations, they start at 8 weeks old and they go all up until to the age of 14. And then again, you'll be needing vaccines as you get later on in life. And we're not expecting you or anyone to know exactly what vaccine they need when. But if you are concerned about, and you will be contacted by your GP when you do need vaccines, but if you're concerned that your kid hasn't been up to date with their vaccine, you can contact your GP.
Nobody needs vaccines. That was Dr. Sonia somebody or other who often appears on Sky News with Kate Burley. You see the lockstep nature of that. You had it in Dublin, you had it in London. Same time, morning, the morning rush hour. Let's get them thinking about vaccines and about those who are immunosuppressed and who can't have the jab themselves, and measles is coming back and all of that jazz. It's terrible, this, isn't it? You know, this is going to get worse and worse. I don't know if I have time to do it because I did it on the Papers podcast this morning. But I think it's the biggest story of the day, really. It's that story in the Times about how they want to redraw or broaden the government's definition of extremism as part of a crackdown on people who undermine Britain's institutions and values. Okay? They want to define extremism as vocal, that's expressing your opinion or sharing your thoughts, or active opposition to fundamental British values and institutions. Now, the NHS is an institution, as is the monarchy, as is the government itself, the Palace of Westminster, right? As is the army, an institution. So they want to broaden the definition of extremism to make it much easier for them to label things as extremist, like maybe me saying you don't need any vaccines. I don't believe anybody needs a vaccine for anything, personally. Now, I always say that you should make your own decisions and not listen to me, because all I am is all I am. I'm certainly no doctor. I'm certainly no medical expert, but I'm a pretty decent researcher. I don't think anybody needs a vaccine. I really don't, right? But I might not be able to say that in the future. That's something I'm going to get into with John Waters in a few minutes. Not vaccines and stuff, but the changing of the definition of extremism to make it very easy for governments to say, you are an extremist. Something needs to be done about you. Let's talk about something else. James Whale is still alive, can you believe it? He's had stage 4 cancer, I think, since 1927. It feels that long. He's been whinging about, and I'm glad he's alive. I wouldn't wish death on anybody. I really wouldn't. It's a bad karma. It doesn't get you anywhere. But he's a prat, James Whale, and he's still making a prat of himself today, or yesterday in this case. He was interviewing Muhammad Amin, who's a conservative, a former chair of the Conservative Muslim Forum. And this guy went on to say, Muhammad Amin, that from the river to the sea has different contexts, and you cannot determine that somebody is calling for the genocide of Israel or the genocide of the Jews in Israel because they use the phrase from the river to the sea. Muhammad Amin, former chair, Conservative Muslim Forum.
Well, the phrase from the river to the sea does depend on its context. For example, it's used in the charter of the Likud political party in Israel. They're obviously not using it with genocide. Yeah, but originally
it's very important to mention that. The Likud political party in Israel uses the chant, obviously not calling for the extermination of the Jews.
It comes from clearing the Jews out in a genocide and pushing them into the sea.
It is the most offensive thing you could say.
I mean, the most offensive thing you could say, says James Whale.
Let's not beat about the bush. Let's not be nice about it.
Let's not be nice.
From the river to the sea, shouted by the people who are shouting it, echoed by the mindless morons who are the majority of the marchers, don't even know what they're talking about.
The mindless morons who are the majority of the marchers, he says. I'd be very careful if I was him walking around London.
Haven't even got a clue.
If I was him, I'm not advocating any harm for him, but I wouldn't be calling people mindless morons, and the majority of them are calling for the genocide of the Jews. If I lived and worked in London, I wouldn't be doing that.
As to what happened around the, I'm quite old, around the founding, if you like, of Israel and how all of that happened. It is saying we want to get rid of Israel, we want our country back, and that's
what... If that's what they're saying, what's wrong with that? We want to get rid of Israel, the state, the country. We want our land back. It's pretty legitimate to me, at least just to me.
What we're going to do. So it's really promoting genocide.
If
promoting genocide, the majority are calling for genocide, said Whale, who is as thick as pig shit. Listen to this.
Somebody is using it to talk about genocide. If somebody is using it to say we want to expel Jews from Israel, then that's clearly wrong. But that is not the way that everybody uses that.
Are you yeah, but that's sort just of a minute. That's sort of irrelevant, though, isn't it? That's irrelevant, because there is a section of the community, the Jewish community, that says that. So why are you carrying on with it when you know the Jewish community finds it offensive?
I didn't know you were a mind reader.
Oh, but you are, James. You're a mind... He's not a mind reader, but you are a mind reader. He can't say that many of these people are not calling for the genocide of the Jews, but you can say that they are.
Because you can't tell what's in somebody's mind when they shout out this appalling thing.
Except for you.
It is saying we want to get rid of Israel, we want our country back, and that's what we're going to do. So it's really promoting genocide.
What a dickhead James Whale is. 26 minutes past the hour of 4 o'clock. You're listening to The Richie Allen Show. And extremism and MPs going about their business and what can be said on the internet and not be said on the internet was also a subject discussed on the BBC Politics Live television show today with, God, I'm going to struggle here, Danny Sriskanjaraja. I got it in one. From the New Economics think tank, right? Heather Wheeler, Tory MP. And then I think your woman, what's her name? Angela Eagle from Labour. Have a listen to some of this. It's interesting.
A concern that we have been chipping away at some of those civic...
So this is Danny Sriskanjaraja. He's saying that there's a problem with... We're losing freedoms in this country that have been hard won, okay?
Big freedoms that Angela has been talking about, the freedom of assembly, the freedom of association, the freedom of expression in this country. If you want an international comparison, Civicus, a global organisation, monitors civic freedoms in 195 countries. Britain, you'd expect to be at the top of the league, is in the middle on a 5-point scale. Britain gets rated as obstructed for civic freedoms in this country. And, if we want to preserve and protect democracy, we need to make sure that people have the ability to express themselves, to assemble peacefully. Now, of course, if there are threats to someone's safety and privacy...
Because people have been demonstrating outside MPs' homes.
We need curbs, but to come down too hard on that has a bigger risk, which is to undermine those fundamental freedoms.
I genuinely don't know who this group are that you're talking about.
This is Heather Wheeler, Tory MP.
But... So you've got a bunch of people who have been on a march and they're on the tube and they're doing their chanting, and then the tube driver says the same thing, from the river to the sea. And now, if you happen to be a Jewish person going about your business and you're trying to get home, and that mob have taken over that tube carriage, how do you think you're going to feel?
But that's outrageous. Let's remember also that...
And this is Angela Eagle, Labour.
There's lots of hate attacks on... black ethnic minority people, including Muslims, going on at the moment.
It's gone
on. I'm from the LGBT community. There's
What? You're from what? This makes me laugh every time I hear it. It makes me laugh.
I'm from the LGBT community.
She's from the LGBT community. I've come here today from the LGBT community.
Lots of attacks on LGBT people, trans people particularly. We need to create a society...
Oh, Jesus, Mary and Joseph. It's a race to the bottom, isn't it? With every ridiculous identity group in this fucking country. It's a race to the bottom. We are the most oppressed. No, you're not. We are. Shut up. No, that's racist. You can't say you're more oppressed than us. That's racist. There's less of us than there are of you. And so on and so on. It is 29 minutes past the hour. Thank you for your messages. I'll begin to read them now, if I can bring them up on my screen. It's the Richie Allen Show. What else is it? Live from BBG Towers here in Salford. You can leave a message via the website, but I do recommend you download the application for the Richie Allen Show. Thank you. Okay, David has been in touch. We'll tell you what we're going to do. Isaac says, Julia Hartley Brewer is evil, says Isaac. Evil. She's probably not evil, Isaac. But he says, the way she justifies 30,000 dead on Talk TV this morning is beyond the pale. She's obviously only got the job in the first place as a Zionist Jew, says Isaac. I don't know anything about Julia Hartley Brewer's background. I'm not sure she's Jewish. Is she Brewer? And it doesn't really matter whether she is or whether she isn't. I doubt she's trying to justify 30,000 dead. I will check out the clip, though, if you do provide me a link, and we'll see what's going on there. Hi to Corey, who says, we already have Black History Month every year across all schools in the UK. Hi to Denise, who says, Richie, the world has gone mad. We spent years looking back at history and being horrified and in disbelief at the things that happened and being kidded that we learned from the wrongdoings that happened. Now, here we are years and years later being punished and facing humiliation for things way before we were born, long before our lifetime. They're trying to condition us and our children as if we have some responsibility, says Denise. It is preposterous, Denise. There's no doubt about it. Kay says the Church of England Birmingham have an advert at the moment for an anti-racism practice officer. And in brackets, it says deconstructing whiteness, regional racial justice. Salary, £36,000 plus a pension, says Kay. It is insane, Kay. It is absolutely insane. I don't know what else you could say about it other than here's some music from the aforementioned Bruce the Boss Springsteen. This is his cover version of Turn Back the Hands of Time. Deedle-deedle-dee-dee. I'm Richie Allen, by the way. Welcome to the Richie Allen Show, Monday's edition. Turn Back the Hands of Time from Bruce Springsteen on the Richie Allen Show. 26 minutes it is to the top of the hour. I'm going to open the website now and read some comments. I've been quaffing water in the musical interlude there, quaffing it to try and quieten, dampen my throat. I'm going to whinge again. I'm going to complain again. Little spider there. Little spider running across the desk. Small, sufficiently small to not trigger a panic attack where I would run out the studio screaming for my missus to come and deal with it. No, I've never done that. But I'm not too fond of the old eight-legged arachnids. Not too fond of them at all. Can't open up the website. It's obviously very busy. I know you are leaving comments there. Do leave a comment for me, or two or three, at the Richie Allen Show app. Download the app. If your provider tells you you're in the wrong country, don't worry about it. Download a VPN and do it that way, and then you can use it. Lots of Irish people using the app. And they were previously told they couldn't because it wasn't available in their area. Hi to Derek, who says it is well known in sociology and cultural Marxism that institutions are highly important to people's development of arguments, ideas and self. It is said we find our identities in the cracks of great institutions, he says, by investigating, opposing or supporting disappointment, etc. If Gen Z are boring non-entities now, if we cannot criticise institutions, how much worse is it going to get in 20 years, asks Derek. Worse, Derek. Yes, no doubt about it. Neil said James Whale just happened to turn off comments on his socials. The absolute coward. I could have really hurt James Whale about 3 years ago, and I chose not to do it because I couldn't be arsed. He had some idiot on from Hope Not Hate, this ridiculous organisation which is funded by various special interest groups that are determined to shut down free speech. So he had a fool on there from Hope Not Hate, which claims to be a charity, which is trying to end hate on the internet. Ridiculous, right? And I got a phone call from Hayden Hewitt. You probably heard me tell the story before. Hayden rings me up and I'd finished my own show. And he said to me, you might want to turn on talk radio. They're talking about you. And I said, why would they be talking about me? And I turned it on. And this cretin from Hope Not Hate, a real loser now. I genuinely can't think of his name. If I could think of his name, I would be naming him right now. But I can't think of it. He's inconsequential in any case. So this guy was basically calling me a Nazi. In fact, he did call me a Nazi. And suggested that I was an anti-Semite and I hated Jews and my whole platform was about hating Jews and all of this sort of stuff. So, of course, this didn't bother me at all. But I did two things. I contacted Talk Radio by telephone and demanded that I be brought on air for right of reply. They hung up on me. I tweeted Whale to say something along the lines of, you're supposed to be a journalist. I'm right here. So anytime you want, I'll DM my number to you and you can bring me on. And Whale blocked me on Twitter. And they didn't bring me on. I could have ruined them. I mean, I really could have ruined them. If I'd have gone to Ofcom and complained, I would have ruined them. No doubt about it. But I just couldn't be arsed. I thought to myself, well, you know, there's no such thing as bad publicity in the end. But it was very interesting at the time. I couldn't get over it. Whale being so experienced, I thought, well, he'll be thrilled that I'm reaching out because, you know, I've been libelled. And if somebody libels somebody on your radio show, the best possible thing that can happen is if the person who has been libelled phones up and demands to be allowed on, because then you're covering your arse, right? But no, they blocked me, and the guy on the reception at Talk Radio hung up on me. I said, mate, you know, I'm obviously a much more qualified and much more experienced journalist than you are. You've got to put me on the air. Do you understand how it works? This guy's called me a Nazi. I've got to get on there with this guy. They wouldn't let me on. James Whale, yeah, yeah. What a tosspot. It is exactly 2 minutes to the top of the hour. This is Monday's Richie Allen Show. I cannot wait for John Waters. He'll be with me in a couple of minutes' time, less than that. But also this week, Fred and Richard Fairbrass, right said Fred, will be on the programme tomorrow. First time in over a year, I think. Probably longer. And I can't wait for that either. It's going to be a good old week on your Richie Allen Show. Let's give John a ring. John Waters, we love a bit of John Waters. He's a terrifically talented writer. He's been writing in the Irish broadsheet media for many, many years. He's written a number of brilliantly successful books, brilliantly readable books. And for many years, he regaled us with his opinions and thought-provoking points of view on Irish television and radio. It's a real pleasure. He's got a Substack account, John Waters. I, of course, will put links to it on the podcast notes. I know that many of you are connected to John on Substack in any case. It's a real pleasure to welcome him back to our programme. Good evening, John. Welcome.
Good evening, Richie. How are you doing?
I'm all the better because you're here, and I mean that. Thanks for coming back on. I look forward to it, and so do our listeners. We're going to talk about quite a few things in the time that we have today, which is as much as you would like to go to 6 o'clock. I was just going to, obviously, the referenda, very important, but also the British government attempting to broaden the definition of extremism. Neither you nor I, and you're far more experienced than me, we don't do sensationalism or any such nonsense. But this is incredible. It looks to me that the British government is looking to broaden its own definition of extremism so that it can basically accuse anybody who might take issue with an institution of the state, be it the police, be it the NHS, be it the Palace of Westminster itself, that anybody who vocally is the telling a part of this article, I think, and what they're trying to do, that you might stand up and say, I don't think the NHS is acting in the interest of the British people. I think they might be causing more harm than good. And you might find yourself in serious trouble and labelled as an extremist. I know you read this article yourself today. This is not funny stuff, John, is it? This is serious stuff.
No, this is a trend that has come from the United States and it's been pushed by the Democratic Party in a big way and the Biden administration, you know, that they've been trying to do this thing. And in fact, it goes back even further, back to Obama, where they're basically trying to make anybody... They're changing the very meaning of democracy in the first place. Democracy, by this definition now, is no longer the voice of the people. It's the institutions of the allegedly democratic state. And anybody, therefore, who is hostile or in any way, you know, critical of them is a potential enemy of the state and an enemy of democracy. That's the way it goes now. And this is the meaning of all of this nonsense that we've been hearing for the last 2 years about the far right. And all of us knowing that in our societies, in most of our societies, there is no such thing as a far right. And in those societies where there is a far right, it's a kind of a dad's army far right, you know, yeah. This is non-existent. So this has been the summoning up of, you know, in groupthink terms, the out-group, which galvanizes the in-group by its existence or by its phantom existence, as it is in this case. And that's essentially what's going on. That's the beginning of it. And now in this, what they do, they create these new concepts like domestic terrorism. whereby, you know, putting out a tweet which is hostile to the government is pretty much the same as planting a bomb in a railway station in terms of its consequences for you, for the perpetrator. This is really where it's all going. And it's become, it's beyond frightening, Richie. It's beyond, you know, it really opens up that seam of thought in one that we thought we had dealt with, which is that our you know, certain things could never happen in Western civilization, could never happen in Western society. Because why? Well, we weren't entirely sure why. Well, we had such settled values and we had free speech and we had all of these things that were all the checks and balances, all the safeguards. They were, so we slept easily. It never occurred to us that actually something could happen which would change entirely the fabric of our lives in civic terms and in, therefore in existential terms. And that change really has to do, in my opinion, with the World Economic Forum, which has become a kind of a supranational political party. If you look at your political landscape now in the UK or Ireland, and indeed in almost every European country or in America, there's this concept that has increasingly been called the uni party, which essentially means that all parties are essentially saying the same thing. And what that actually means is that they're all literally beholden to the supra uni party, which is the World Economic Forum. And all this stuff has been channeled into the system by this. But it's essentially, it came out of America and the American deep state, the CIA, all these organizations were, the FBI, they started to create this sense of, and it originated out of Trump's election, really. That it was decided this is enough now. You know, democracy's gone too far. If Donald Trump can get elected, that's a bridge too far. And that was reflected in the papers. If you look at, and indeed even over here, like, there are people, you know, walking around the streets here who think nothing of saying something to you along those lines. And then when you ask for evidence, they don't have any evidence that Trump is anything other than just a slightly colourful, big mouth. They don't have any other evidence, but they're already convinced by the propaganda that this is the greatest threat to democracy that's ever happened. And if you read previously sober columnists in newspapers, not that I read them too much, but I see headlines and I see flashes here and there, they write columns about this as if, Trump's first name was Adolf.
Yeah. Yeah, I find this fascinating too. You're right. I think for many, they won't look beyond the screaming headline that Trump is a Nazi. Now, I have looked beyond it. And when Trump was elected in 2016, I took the point of view that very little would change and that the agenda, or the agendas that I've been considering and speaking about with guests for years, would proceed in any case and that Trump wouldn't really be, any barrier to these agendas. And I still think I'm right. Now, a lot of my listeners are big Trump supporters, and fair enough, they tolerate me in any case, but I don't see Trump as any different than Hillary Clinton or Bill Clinton, in the long run, really,
Well, he's different in this sense, and I mean, this is slight diversion, but he, just to be clear, from what my perspective on Trump is that the most important about Trump is not Trump, it's his people. The people who see in him the capacity to save their country and to save their part in their country, to return to them the democratic voice which was taken from them in the switchover of the Democratic Party from, a party of the blue-collar working class, which it had been for since the beginning, to becoming a party of, woke minorities, let's say. And of course, in Britain, the Brexit thing is just as significant in this context, because that again set off the alarms among those who really, the permanent government are very tolerant of divergence of political views so long as the band is kept very narrow and so long as it's within their control. And therefore, when they can have a Tweedledum, Tweedledee situation, election after election, there's no cause to panic. But Brexit caused a massive panic because it seemed, first of all, it seemed coming close that it wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it did happen. And they don't like surprises.
No, and then it didn't happen, sadly. I mean, I got my polling card and I wouldn't have voted in a general election since the 2002 election in Ireland. because I became so disillusioned, and I at least I felt I began to understand what was really going on with the uniparty system you brilliantly described a few minutes ago. So what I did was, my polling card came in and I went up to the primary school where we lived in Fallowfield in Manchester, and I cast my vote for Leave. But I never believed it would happen. And I mean, it was a stitch up from day one. I mean, they came out and they said, all right, now we have Article 50 or whatever it was. You've now got 2 years to negotiate your way out before you're actually out. And all of these shenanigans began. And I believe to this day, John, that the UK has not left the European Union, not in any meaningful sense.
No, it hasn't, and it never will. I mean, there are some minor consequences for ordinary people. You know, one of them, I noticed recently that people, British citizens who had houses in Spain, who were living in Spain, now have to return to Britain every 3 months. And they can spend 3 months in Spain, and then they have to go back to Britain for 3 months, and then they can come for another 3 months to Spain, that kind of thing. These are the only consequences. They're adverse consequences for ordinary people, many of whom would have voted unwittingly for Brexit, not knowing that that was one of the consequences that would actually be implemented. And you see, so if you're looking at all these systems, we're a lot wiser, Richie, I think. Certainly I am, in relation to politics than I was before 2020, because I kind of believed, I did believe in the democratic system. I believed that it was functional. I didn't believe necessarily in a very naive way that it was, you know, capable of doing whatever the people wanted. But it seemed that within a fairly wide band, it was amenable to the will of the people. Now I realise that that was an illusion, which was predicated on the fact that the parties were themselves designed to stay within a very narrow band anyway, and not offer people, or at least not offer, not enable a party that was offering anything much broader, any real chance of getting into power.
Can I ask you a question on that? Do you mind? The beautiful thing about having you on is the segues. What does it do to a man or a woman? What does it do to them when they throw their lot in with somebody and they believe them, like they believed Donald Trump, they believed Boris Johnson, and then they're let down as badly as they're let down? What does it do to them in the context of Brexit, for example?
Well, you've already seen that in America, Richie, before Trump. And this is the interesting thing about Trump, that he seemed to be the one who was put an end to it. But back before that, as a result of the process that I'm describing here, a whole tranche of men, working men, had basically pulled out of the workplace, had pulled out of civic life, had pulled out of everything, and gone back into their boroughs, as it were, with their drinks and their pills and their TV sets. And they were literally sitting there. It's a very well documented phenomenon. And they were basically disengaged. And Donald Trump came along. And they sort of heard this clamoring outside the window, maybe metaphorically, you know, and they didn't know what it was. And they pulled the curtains, and then it kept going and it kept going. And one day they had a look out and they saw there was all their neighbors around the streets cheering this man with the strange orange head on him, you know. And what the hell is this? Now, that's a paradoxical situation, because Donald Trump was the last person on earth that you would have chosen, predicted to fill that particular gap. But it was precisely because of his FU personality to the system that allowed him to fill that. And that's what happens, Richie, to answer your question. Disillusionment, alienation, these terrible diseases of the spirit creep in.
Yeah, it's horrible.
They're very hard to shift. And that's going to happen, you see. You know, we're in a very dark, because they're doing this to everybody now. Like, it's not just the blue collar workers any longer. It's everybody now is being treated like this. All of the populations of the West, even though many of huge tranches of them still don't understand this or realize it, they're being basically treated in that same way, basically told implicitly and sometimes explicitly. You are now surplus to requirements. Shut your mouth and sit down and don't be making trouble.
Don't make any noise, yeah. Do you know
what? And that's the meaning of what that thing of seeking extremists, because you see, obviously people in that frame of mind tend to be angry. And when they go on the streets, they tend to get involved. A lot of them will, or certain numbers of them will get in confrontation with cops, rightly or wrongly. And then you see they have the pretext and the excuse to start hammering them with the batons. Yeah. And to justify this on the basis that they're extremists, you see, this is what it's all about. This is what the hate speech thing is about, where they can take your computer, and if there's nothing on, they'll probably put something on it. Do you know what I mean? And so on. Like, this is beyond. I'm astonished, Richie, because this last week has been a bit of a trial for me in this context, because I've met an unusual number of people, and I won't say how many, because they might recognise themselves, who basically I've engaging in sort of more extended than usual conversations about the state of things. And these are people who think they know everything that's going on in reality, but actually know nothing, because everything they know is predicated on watching television, watching RTE. And they get into arguments, and I'll say something and they'll contradict me and say, ah, no, that's a conspiracy theory, you know. No, please, please don't say that. It's nonsense. Listen to me. Like, for example, Chinese credit system. If I mentioned that, some guy, I said, no, this is real now. You got to pay attention because this is real. And somebody sent me a lectury kind of a note about, you know, something I said about Putin that wasn't like Putler. You know what I mean? I wasn't calling him Putler, you know. And he was horrified at this. And he started talking about Navalny and all this sort of stuff. And I said, I don't want to get into whataboutery, but, you know, what about Julian Assange? Have you written to anybody about him? No. Or indeed, in the Irish context, Enoch Burke, very close to home, who's been in jail now for something like coming up to, I would say, 4 months, maybe more. Well over 100 days anyway. And for refusing to call a student, essentially. Now, they'll come up with all kinds of nonsense about him, just if he purged his contempt, he'd be able to go home. There's a principle at stake here. He says, I will not say something that isn't true. And he refused to use a plural pronoun for a singular.
Yeah, but isn't some of it also to do with the fact that he keeps turning up at the school and they've asked him not to? They've told him, look, enough is enough now. Is there some?
Yeah, but you see, Richie, I tend to agree with him about this. He was employed as a teacher to teach, among other things, the English language. And one day they told him, well, you're going to have to call this single individual person who's whatever, I can't remember, was it from he to she or she to he, but it doesn't matter. You have to use the pronoun they.
Yeah.
And then you
pick up the preposterous.
Then he's expected to pick up the grammar books, you see, and start talking about plurals and singulars.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? Oh, it's ridiculous. It's ludicrous. Yeah.
So he's going to his job to do what he was employed to do, which is an honourable thing to do.
Yeah.
Whereas the people who put him in this situation are not doing an honourable thing.
Let me do something. Segueing. John Waters is our guest, Irish writer, academic, broadcaster, writer of brilliant books, by the way. And I'm not just saying that. johnwaters.substack.com. John, we're going to talk about the Irish referenda in a moment. Correct me if I should say referendums, but I think it's
referendums. You say, let's call the whole thing off.
Let's call the whole bloody thing off, yeah. But John mentioned a second ago that he's been speaking with people and they bring up the old conspiracy theory garbage when he mentions social credit and China. John, have a listen to this. I always brag, John. I have an audio bank going back 10 years, but in particular the last 3.5 years. I saved every bit of tyranny. I've got all the MP3s. I think it's about 4,500 audio clips. But here's Bill de Blasio when he was mayor of New York. And John Waters has been in contact with Irish people who are asleep at the wheel because they don't think that social credit is coming. Listen to Bill de Blasio.
So today I announce a new approach, which we're calling the Key to NYC Pass. The key to New York City. When you hear those words, I want you to imagine the notion that because someone's vaccinated, they can do all the amazing things that are available in this city. This is a miraculous place, literally full of wonders. And if you're vaccinated, all that's going to open up to you. You'll have the key. You can open the door. But if you're unvaccinated, unfortunately, you will not be able to participate in many things. That's the point we're trying to get across. It's time for people to see vaccination as literally necessary to living a good and full and healthy life.
Yeah, there's another part to it, which I'm not going to play because it's a minute and 16 seconds long, where he says you will not be allowed to participate in public life unless you take your medicine. So this is building. Now, you might say that didn't happen. It didn't, as far as I understand, in New York City. But it's out there. It's out there.
the threat was there. Well, you see, I have a very strange response to that now, Richie, and I'll try to explain it, which is that even though I fought that, even though I was appalled by it, in a certain sense, Richie, I still do not believe it is that it actually happened. Because I have such a kind of a reservoir of belief and trust and confidence and faith in the democratic system and in its capacity to endure against such tyrannies.
Yeah.
That I think, did I make a mistake? Did we misunderstand what they were saying? It seems clear enough there. They did. We've heard numerous people. We've heard politics. This is what I'm talking about, the WEFers, like the mother WEFers, the World Economic Forum, the representatives of the few, which is the reverse spelling of WEF.
Yeah.
That appalling wretch over in New Zealand there for the last 3 years. She's gone now, thanks be to God.
Ardern, yeah.
Yeah, like she was threatened to say, she with this awful smile on her face was asked a question, you know, well, so you seem to be saying like that, you know, people who aren't vaccinated will not be. Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. You know?
Yeah, it's crazy.
But you see, this is the key in my view, though. The WEF is a school for tyrants. And they go off and they spend, I don't know where they get the money, do they have to put it up themselves? It's 200,000 actually to go through the full course. And when you come out, then you're a fully polished tyrant. Our man is the rat creep person. He got the whole degree. He got the master's in tyranny. Martin, who was his deputy, probably only got a bachelor of tyranny,
yeah.
You know?
You think Radker's worse, yeah?
Oh,
no doubt.
He's the guy they're all trying to catch up with, to be as ignorant and as fascistic as the, you know, that he's the model. He's the gold standard, you know, in totalitarian, demeanor and visage. That's where that's coming from. You see that tone and that the demeanor and that sense of, you know, here's a straw, suck it up, you know?
Yeah. Well, look, we're on to him, so we're on to the referendums this coming Friday. I'll read from the Mirror, from the Irish Mirror. It's a big week for the government as the country heads to the polls for the first time in 4 years for the referendums on family and care. And it goes on to talk about what the referendum is about. And let me just read a little bit of that for our listeners who don't know. The Family Amendment, the first vote referred to as the Family Amendment, will ask people to expand the definition of a family to include those in durable relationships. Varadkar would say, well, you know, families are not what they were in 1950s Ireland. We have same couple families. We have families who are not married. He would say, that's all it's about. I don't know what all of this fuss is about. Varadkar might say, why are the far right in Ireland getting their knickers in a twist about this? Now, you're not far right. You're a proper journalist. Why are people getting their knickers in a twist about it, the change to the family amendment of the Constitution?
Well, first of all, it's not what you said there, in that what they say. It's what you said, they said, and you were correct in your description of what they're suggesting.
What they're suggesting, yeah.
About alternative families. But unfortunately, Richie, I'm the wrong man to be saying that too, because I was there for the past 25, 30 years, arguing on this precise point, year after year after year in the Irish Times, about family law, about the treatment of fathers, about the marginalisation of single fathers, the denial of fundamental rights to single fathers, and by extension, and indeed not by extension, but actually discrimination against the children of single fathers who had a lesser guarantee of having a relationship with their father than a child in the next seat in the school whose father was married to her mother. And I have gone through two of those categories now, and I can tell you, I'll go through it very briefly. There are basically, they're talking about 400,000 couples, something like that, who will benefit from this. Well, there's 150,000 of those which are called cohabiting couples. 75,000, half of those, have children. Now, those are all couples who could get married but won't, don't want to. And that's entirely their prerogative, yes, in my view. But if you opt out, you opt out. So you don't, the idea that the state can then come in or should come in and insist that you're going to be part of some marriage type of situation against your will, more or less, is not helping them in any way, that they couldn't help themselves by simply getting the few quid together, putting down the deposit and going off and getting married. Now, that's the first. So that's 150,000. The rest of those then are single unmarried parents, male or female, who are in a sense bringing up their children on their own. There's 186,500 women, mothers, in that category, and there's 33,500 fathers. Now, again, nothing here will make any difference to their lives. They will be the same exactly as they were before. The fathers will actually, now the fathers, you see, the mothers, interestingly, the mothers, unmarried mothers in Irish law, as a result of case law, interpretation of the Constitution, have as almost identical position in law and equality and so on to married mothers, because they get the full benefits of Article 40, which is the fundamental right, natural rights. But fathers have never been given natural rights in law by any case. In fact, there has been a single case going back to the 1960s called the Nicolau case, in which a father was seeking to try to stop the adoption of his child. And he failed on the basis that the court found that he was not entitled to the protections of the Constitution as a family. He and his child were not a family. And his child was taken away literally from his arms and adopted over his head.
Jesus.
And I've seen this happen time and again, Richie. And that still obtains. None of these creeps, Richie. I wrote about this for 20-odd years in the Irish Times. And none of these creeps. Five politicians came to me, Richie, and asked me to expand on it. And most of them did. None of them did anything. One or two of them were reasonably polite about it, but they did nothing. And that's still the case. A mother, an unmarried mother, has rights, natural rights under Article 40, not under Article 41, which is the one that's at stake in this particular referendum. An unmarried father hasn't. Now, where that's even worse, Richie, in the context of what they're doing here, and you actually think about the concept of durable relationships. And I was, remember, I'm a single father. And this is something I was very alert to all these years. That when I had joined custody after a long struggle, and in the UK courts, in the English and Wales courts, I got it, and so I was able to manage that on a certain, you know, and it's not an ideal situation by any means, and I never said, by the way, that being an unmarried parent should be the same or regarded the same or even treated the same as a married parent, or that we shouldn't elevate marriage to a higher level. I believe in that passionately, I do. But what I say is that you don't, for that reason, have to treat other people like dogs.
I hear you, but why is the marriage certificate so important? It's just a piece of paper allocated by the state. You know, I don't see how a married couple are more, and I'm going to choose my language poorly here, because I can't think of anything else to say. I've cohabited with Caroline for 22 and a half years. Yeah. I don't think that a married couple, because they had the registry office or went to church, I don't think they should have any special privileges that I don't have.
No, I hear what you're saying, Richie. And indeed, the legal situation now is almost that anyway. The cohabiting couples are de facto, if not entirely de jure, you know, given the same respect, etc., in society as a married couple. But I still believe that there is an ideal in all things, you know. And it doesn't mean a moral ideal. It doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, somebody who doesn't attain that ideal is less worthy or moral or decent or anything like that, I don't think. But it, you know, that a society, you know, if we imagine like a society in which there was no such thing as marriage and everything, you know, was just people just, I think that it would be a different kind of society and probably a lesser one in the sense that it would be more chaotic than it is at the moment. It's very like, and there is something special about, you know, making that pledge to somebody else, in my view, you know, that I'm married now and I've been married for about 8 or 9 years. And I think that definitely, you know, that the idea of actually making that oath and you know, it's a very moving thing, you know, and I do believe in it. But I have always said, and it is a case now, and there's a case come up, Richie, in the past couple of weeks, in which the points that I was making 20 years ago are now being made by Supreme Court judges, because there was a case coming up, came up about pensions, and a man who was widowed, or no, his partner, not he wasn't married, but he had three children, they had three children, and she died young. And he found that he wasn't entitled to get the widower's pension, even though he was rearing his three children on his own and so on. And this went to the Supreme Court. And they could have dealt with it on the basis of the fundamental right in relation to the family. And they could have turned that over. But by a majority, they chose not to. And they concentrated instead on equality within social welfare legislation, which is kind of a bit of a cop-out in another sense. But two of the judges went the other way, and they took apart the thing I'm talking about, the Nicolau judgment about the adopted father, the father whose child was adopted, and they made absolute shreds of it. And they pointed out that it actually, even from the very beginning, lots of judges thought it was a bad judgment. And yet that has been the kingpin, that has been the centerpiece of family law for the past 50 years. And of the brutalization of countless fathers and their children in that period. I tried to resist this and tried to reason against it. And as I say, politicians just weren't interested. And one of the things that has maddened me more than anything else in my professional life in the last 30, 40 years, is the way those same politicians then jumped on the LGBTQ, PQB, whatever.
XYZ, yeah.
on the wagon. And while contemptuously dismissing what I had said in relation to fathers and children, who, whatever you think about LGBT, is what are 1-2% of the population. We're talking, when you talk about fathers, straight off the bat, potentially of 50% of the population being fathers, potentially, and then all the children that will be implicated in that. Totally treated with contempt, and again in this measure, which will do nothing for them. In fact, Richie, it may very well make things worse, because what it seems to me, the one area where it's going to benefit is in second relationships. And what I mean by that is that if you can imagine a relationship that breaks up, maybe a cohabiting relationship, and there are children or a child, let's say one child, and that child, the mother gets custody under the usual mechanisms, and the father is slightly out in the cold, but he's a bit of a McDonald's dad or whatever, you know,
yeah,
maybe a little better than that. But then the mother gets involved in a new relationship, and it could be a straight relationship or it could be a lesbian relationship. It doesn't matter. That new partner, through this measure, will acquire far more rights than the natural father of those. That
are you sure about this now?
I'm 100% sure.
Yeah.
There's nothing else that can happen, Richie. I've gone into this in every way. I've been writing about this.
I know you're an expert on it. I know you've been writing about it for years.
Because the point is, the durable relationship, it cannot, by definition, apply to the father and child. That's not what it's about. Do you understand? There are tests already for that within the family law system. They apply all kinds of rubrics in that relationship, in that context, you know, of, well, how much time? I mean, for example, you know, they brought in a thing about guardianship there a few years ago. And this is very interesting, whereby previously the law was that a father could get, there were two ways a father could get guardianship of his child, which is basically to get legal standing, to have any position legally in your child's life at all. And one way is you got a letter from the mother saying that she had no objection. And the other way was then, if she failing that you could go to court over her head, and then if she chose to fight you, you could, you know, good luck with that, right? Now, they changed that back about 2015 in a new law that came in. It was enabling legislation that had to do with the gay marriage thing, essentially. And the provision there was then that any father could get automatic guardianship of his child, provided that he had lived 12 months with the mother of the child, including 3 months in the life of the child. Right?
Yeah.
Now, I'll say something about that. In Ireland now, where it's almost impossible for young fellas and young people to get accommodation for themselves, never mind for a family, that the chances of most of the fathers in that situation being able to meet that criterion are close to zero. Moreover, that in that sort of situation, by definition, you're going to be having to prove something which is unprovable, other than if the mother agrees that you were living there, because who else is going to certify that? That's one thing. Now, but you see, this is the way that this used to be, that in all of these things, there were criteria, rightly or wrongly. And that I would say they were wrongly. Those criteria are completely wrong. They're the wrong way of looking at the issue. But interestingly, in this, there are no criteria at all. In this new wording, there's no definition of durable. It's left to the judges to decide what durable means. Now, durable, the only place, durable doesn't appear in the Constitution already. It's not as if it's a common legal word in Ireland. But it does appear in European legislation, and it appears specifically in migration legislation. So this is what it is really about, is family reunification. It is when somebody comes to Ireland, they pay 10 grand to a people trafficker, they come across, they get into Ireland, they get accommodation, of course, money, of course, you know, all they need. And then they start bringing their other family members over. This is what, now make no mistake about it, Richard, this is what this is about.
Now, just before you carry on, and you know where you are, so I'm not going to deny you any time, I've got to point out, they say that this is conspiracy junk. And by they, I mean the
this
Irish government.
They always say.
That's
Sorry,
what they say.
Said.
No, they say that, look, they say, oh, the far right are claiming that young man comes into the country because he's on the run because, you know, maybe he's gay and he's coming from a Middle Eastern country. And the far right wants you to believe that he'll use this change, this amendment to the Constitution, to his end, and that he'll be able to bring in family members or several wives. And the government says it's junk. It won't happen.
No,
that's what they say.
It's already happened, Richie. It's already happened even without this. You know, like this idea that, by the way, the gay thing, they don't even bother with that anymore. They just come, they throw their passport, they bin their passports coming off the plane. And they walk up and say, I have no papers. I have no ID.
So many of them are doing
that's
that.
That's what's happened.
Yeah.
Because they're being advised to do that by Irish NGOs. That's the best way of getting in. Clean the sheet, clean sheet, scrub the blackboard and start again.
Did you read the Mail today on this particular subject?
No.
I mean, Jesus, Mary and Joseph. I don't want to blast, I don't want to offend anybody who is religious. But the Mail have conducted an investigation over several months with their own investigation team. And they found that people with connections to some faith groups in this country, but not so much, but you could say NGOs really, are accepting £10,000 and £20,000 from would-be migrants. They're getting them visas, and some of these people can't speak English. None of them have any experience, and they're filling vacancies in the care sector in this country. Would you believe that? So
yeah.
So your gran or your grandmother could be in a care home, and before you know it, some chap, right, who somehow managed to coddle together 20 grand to give to an agent in this country, with no experience, with no English, they're standing in front of a man or a woman who might have dementia or Alzheimer's. It's a massive expose by the Mail of what's going on here.
I'm delighted to hear that, Richie, because that's a real issue now.
Huge.
I mean, Ireland is becoming a terrible place. I want to just address what you're asking there in general, because first of all, I want to go back to what those creeps are saying. And I just want to say that what I said is the truth about it. It's factual, but I want to go for more fundamental. These guys are liars. They lie from the minute they open their eyes in the morning.
The politicians.
Close them at the politicians. They lie and lie and lie. They've been lying for years. I, like a fool, went out for years and wrote about politics and gave them a fair shake. I'm ashamed of that now. I'm ashamed that I give them the time of day, even if at the time things were nothing like as bad as they are now. I feel dirty for having had associations with these people. These people are lying traitors. They are destroying our country for money and to feed money to their mates, so their mates can kick it back to them to buy their election posters. this is what's going on, or part of what's going on. It's a tiny element of what's going on. But fundamentally, I said it before, and I say it again. Come back, Cromwell. All is forgiven.
Imagine saying that. John Waters is our guest. johnwaters.substack.com. There's a lot of comments, so I better read one or two. And we have plenty of time before John comes back in. johnwaters.substack.com. John's a hugely influential Irish writer. The Broadsheet Press, his own books for years. I'll put links on the podcast. Mutual friend of ours has sent me some quotes from various people. She's following people talking about this. She says, one of the things that she's watched or read, she's read, they're trying to make women feel that it is offensive, misogynist and outdated to be a mother caring for her children at home. De Valera had it right. A mother should be protected from economic attack so they can fulfil their fundamental role in caring for children. And that's the next thing we're going to talk about, right? And then Jean Anne says, she says this, and this is interesting now. And I was going to bring this up myself, the whole children's allowance. My mother, in her capacity as social worker, was one of those responsible for getting the children's allowance paid to mothers. By the way, given feckless fathers or partners often drank it away. Obviously, present company excluded. We're not talking about you. But that was always a concern, John, just to kind of bat that one back over the fence at you, over the net at you about fathers. A lot of fathers would drink the children's allowance away, she says. That's an interesting point, that.
Well, you kind of have to be careful with that, though, Richie, in my view. I mean, I'm sure there's some truth in it. But however, I mean, one of the interesting things about the judgment I referred to there last week were two judges, good judges, white hat judges, came up and actually talked about these issues. And one of the things they currently said was that so much law and so much of the case law was based entirely on stereotypes and prejudices of men. And that's a real problem. Now, I wrote about that again recently, and I wrote about this way back, which at the time when I started to discover this precise point, and I won't lose your point there now, because it's, you know, I'm not dismissing it entirely out of hand, but I remember years ago discovering to my absolute shock in the beginning that the research internationally on domestic violence was showing that domestic violence is actually a 50-50 phenomenon. It's not all men beating up women. There's just as much traffic in the other direction.
I can't believe that, John. I can't believe it's 50-50.
Well, that's as they say, the science. And in, no, sorry, I'm saying what it was then, Richie. But in recent times, I wrote about an article written by, I think she was a Canadian psychologist. And she's looking at figures now that are 2-1 the other way. In other words, because license has been extended over the years to women, that they cannot have suffer any consequences whatsoever. They'll batter their husbands, they'll batter their boyfriends. No bother. And that's happening because the pattern that was clear back then to me, and I'm talking about 25 years ago, was that men who were in this situation, and I did meet them, and they would go into a Garda station, into a cop shop, and start talking about what had happened. And the cop behind the counter would say, "Ara, look at the size of you."
They'd be laughed at you.
Yeah. So when you have a culture like that, when you allow things to happen, Rich, you know, like if there was no law against pickpocketing, we'd be all dipping in everyone else's pocket. You know what I mean? That, you know, most people would. Do you know what I mean? Look what's happening in America. With they have this law where I don't know what it is exactly, the amount is, but it's something like $1,000. Anything under $1,000 that's shoplifted, no bother. There's no point in reporting it to the police because they won't come out.
Yeah.
Well, guess what's happening? These guys are reefing every electric store and every kind of a shoe shop and in the cities. Like that's what happens. And this is what happened here. So, you know, this is the extraordinary thing, Richie, that in a culture that we've come through where it was became verboten to be prejudiced about any group whatsoever on the basis of gender, sex, color,
religious
ethnicity,
belief,
blah, blah.
Yeah.
You could still do it to men. You could still say, he's probably hammered her anyway. You know, he's probably tattered her. You know, he'd spend the money on drink. You know, like, could you do that to well, when you when people do it in relation to people coming from abroad, they're told they're racists.
I have to say this on this. I have to say this. Look, I've been doing live radio, independent and commercial, for decades now. It feels like decades. There is a real imbalance in when you look at the rights of the mum and the rights of the dad. I know there is. I've interviewed the lads from Fathers for Justice 1,000 times over the years, and I've met a lot of these guys, these genuine guys, you know. And there is an imbalance. There's no doubt about that. When, especially when it comes to shared custody or access or visitation, there are problems, and I don't think anybody denies that. I can't get my head around that because they do.
They've been denying it for all.
They do, but I can't
understand
why can it not be simple? I don't get. I tell you where I am, and I'm no feminist now. Jesus wept. I couldn't be a feminist. We've been together 23 years. I've already said that. We haven't been blessed with children. I'd love if we had a child. I don't think it'll ever happen. I used to say to Caroline, not, you know, and I meant it and I mean it now, that if we had a child and if the relationship ever ended, there's no way I would try and get permanent custody. Caroline's an amazing woman, so I would believe the child would be better off with Caroline. But so long as she met me halfway and never tried to deny me access.
Well you see, you know, that's the problem, Richie. That's the problem.
I'm the problem.
No, the problem is, no, you're not the problem, Richie. No, I would be the same as you, Richie.
Yeah.
You know, I don't, you know, in principle. But again, you know, this crashes into the other thing we're going to be talking about a little bit, you know. But let me just go through it, because, you see, the problem is that, father, the control is entirely with the mother. And if she chooses to shut the father out, the law assists her in doing so.
I agree. I've seen this with my own eyes in this country. Yes, absolutely.
That's the point. So then yeah. Anything a father gets in these conditions is a concession. It's not a right. If he's nice, if he tiptoes around the place, if he does what he's told, if he's available as a babysitter whenever he's needed, then he'll get to have a reasonable relationship.
Are
with
you
his
telling
child.
Me there's no legislation, John, covering this? I mean, there must be legislation, is there?
There. Well, you can meet a reasonably decent judge now and again, once in a blue moon, who will give. I don't. It's not really about a question of total custody. I mean, you know, that's really quite an arbitrary thing. It's quite acceptable and more acceptable for a child to be, you know, more living with their mother. And in fact, as a child grows older, it's probably better, you know. And indeed, when they're in their very young years, it's probably better if they're in one place most of the time.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah.
And all other things being equal, why shouldn't that be with the mother? The problem is that this is leveraged. These ideas, like the tender years principle, where, you know, that the child comes from that, where the child should be with its mother up to the age of 4. The problem with that one, Richie, is that, and I know of precise cases when this happened, that by the time the child gets to 4 and the father tries to get involved, it's too late. It's impossible to bond. And I know of a lad who killed himself in his late teens in the last few years, arising from precisely the failure of his father, is it the inability of his father to make a relationship with him, having been shut out for several years.
I'm horrified by this, John. I'm horrified that there isn't legislation in place that would protect the dad. So if you do end the relationship or it comes to an end and there's a 2-year-old, I can't understand for the life of me why the dad's right to be in the life of the 2-year-old is not enshrined in law.
Not,
I can't get
my
head around it.
It costs men, a lot of men spend all of their money, every, you know, they spend tens, if not hundreds of thousands of pounds trying to establish relationships and still fail with their children. And then society blames them. It points the finger. Now, there's another factor here that I think was a subtext in what you were saying. I hope I'm not reading you wrong, but it doesn't matter, because it's worth making the point anyway. I'm not attacking anything you're saying and such. But
Jesus, feel free to attack it. We'll never fall out. You can have a go at me all day long. We're old school.
Well,
go ahead.
This is the idea that, oh, well, there are good fathers and there are bad fathers, you know. And that some of them just don't want to know. They walk away. Well, let me tell you, Richie, between ourselves, in a certain sense, I wanted to walk away many a time when I was dealing with the corruption of the English, England and Wales family law system, or the Irish system, less so. I wanted, because I was being driven to absolute distraction by it. It takes superhuman powers, which I was only able to have by virtue of tapping into a certain spiritual source to keep me in the game. See, so because and I can when guys walk away, I no longer judge them. I know why.
Yeah, you went through it. Yeah, you were there. You were that soldier. And
why? Yeah. Like, how is it, Richie, that we never stop talking about equality and fairness and justice and all these things, and still at the same time determinedly withhold it from a certain category of human being, and regard that as some kind of virtue?
It's never discussed anymore either. You used to see Matt from Fathers Connor, for Justice. Matt would often be on Sky, and I would bring him on. I'm not Sky, obviously, but it's one that's ignored. And I know it is going on because, look, I can screen grab this for anybody who doesn't believe me. You've opened up a massive can of worms. I've one here from Bill, not my real name, he says. One from Paul, not my real name, he says. And they're struggling really badly to see their kids. Bill says his kid is 8, and Paul has 2. Both of them are under 10. And relationship ended badly. There was no violence. There was none of that at all. Just ended, and it ended badly. Maybe there was an affair, whatever. But, struggling to see the kids. That's horrible.
You see, that's the thing that happens, Richie, in this context. Particularly with women. You see, there's a whole industry, the family law industry, which is extraordinarily biased against men to the extent that basically most family lawyers will tell you, and you in the first consultation, that you haven't a chance of winning anything. And if you get any recognition or concession at all, you should be grateful to them. You know, that's the now around that whole that industry, there's a whole subculture in which avaricious women who've plundered their husband's resources, let's say, or they've got most of what their husbands had when they met them and afterwards. They meet around and sit around in coffee shops, and any woman who's inclined to be decent, she has to have pretty strong character to hang on to that decency in that culture, because it is designed both by the lawyers and by the feminists driving these whole agendas to actually drive a wedge between fathers and mothers. I always said, Richie, that this was not complicated. And I would say, if I was the state in these situations, I say I am the incarnation of the state, and a couple comes into me and they're broken up, and they've been referred to me, we'll say, for mandatory mediation. This is what I would say to them. Look, you have 2 children, right? Now, I'm very sorry that your romantic relationship, if we can call it that, in a certain gauche kind of way, has broken down. And you know, that's sad. And I know that you're probably, you know, have bad feelings against each other and so on. But I want to say to you on behalf of the state that you're here today as the parents of your children. And we, the state, take a profound interest in the welfare of those children. So this is what needs to happen, and we will help you to make it happen. And we're not blaming anybody. We're just saying it will take you a while to get to a new phase in a relationship where you will no longer be romantically involved in that, but you will have a close bond as parents of your child, of your children. And we want to help you to get to that point in the best way and the easiest way we can do. Can we have your cooperation? And we will. So then you go through a process. If there's somebody who has blockages or resistance, well, then you try and work on that and make them come round and see that there's, you know, happiness for everybody in this. There's a return to some kind of peace in their lives.
Yeah, they and whatever happened to the child is the most important part of this equation. Yeah. And he needs dad as much as mum, and vice versa.
And I'll tell you this, Richie, in my situation, and we got to that stage after a long struggle. And for 10 or 12 years, we had a very, very calm situation. No problems. So it is possible to do it. But the technique of the state is to break it up. The technique of the legal profession is to break it up. They don't want you cooperating. They want conflict.
Money. Fees. Yeah. And yeah. Let me read a couple of comments on this before. I don't want to cut you short here, because this is very important to you, and I know it is, and it sounds like it's very important that you say it today. And I think it is very important that you say it today as well. I don't want to just move away. If you've got more to say on this, it's very interesting. And we are, it's generating an enormous amount.
I think we'll return into it if we go into the other, because the thing that the other referendum,
the woman in the home, yeah,
is related to all of this. The two are connected intimately. And
the care amendment. You
know, when we go into that, we'll find these doors open again for us in a slightly different way.
John Waters is our guest. We've got about 26 minutes left today before we run out of time. johnwaters.substack.com. It's been great getting to know you, pal, since the COVID scam. It's been one of the few, you know, good things about doing the programme, speaking about the same bollocks for 3 years. So it's been great getting to know you, and listeners love listening to you. So,
well, I have to say about this, Richie, I mean, it's extraordinary. You know, this is the only place, really, that it's somehow on the fault line between alternative and mainstream. And it's like both. In what you do, but it's a wonderful thing to be in a situation where you can speak openly about things, and you know you'll get a bit of pushback, as it were. But that's all right. Yeah. It's not obnoxious. It's not hostile, which is what you get in the mainstream, and it's not softball either. I mean, these are important questions, and what has happened to our society more? If I was to pluck out one thing in the last few years that has been disastrous for our society, is that in general these kind of conversations have ceased to happen in most of the places where they should be happening, and that's disastrous because it means that all kinds of things are going to be done which will have no way of being vetted by the public in terms of the wisdom of crowds being applied to new proposals for fixing things, which can very easily get to the very core of what the problem might be, such as in these referendums where the cracks on the fault lines are very obvious now after a few weeks of even a marginal discussion such as we're involved in, because by definition, this is what we're all involved in now. But that nobody in the center of our society seems to value any longer, going back to the point we were talking about in the beginning, the extremism and so on. The idea that that disagreement is the most fundamental element of democracy. You can't have democracy unless you have argumentation.
And everybody is heard. I'm not one for making profound statements, never. It occurred to me a few years ago, I was trying to explain to somebody why I still, not allowed somebody in my life, but why I still had fondness for somebody who did have racist tendencies, let's just say. You know, I got to be honest, it was an older friend going back years who did say some nasty things about people of colour and did kind of mean it. But I never disassociated myself from the person, and my old lefty mates couldn't understand it. And the only thing I could come up with at the time was that, well, we're more than just skin and bones and just one idea, aren't we?
Yes,
this is a man who is a loving father. He raised brilliant children. He was a great neighbour. He was generous. He was generous with his time. He loved people. So that was one aspect of him, that uncomfortable, you know, viewpoint that he had about things. Are you saying to me that I should completely blank the guy for the rest of my life and forget the good thing? He's got a few things in the bank, was what I was saying at the time.
Well,
you know?
You're saying that, Richie, is something that occurs to me. The name that occurs to me is Alf Garnett. Now, I don't know if there's any comparison, but I remember that programme, seeing it occasionally as a child. And the thing about it was, you know, that was not a racist programme in the sense that, you know, there was a complexity about that character and about the relationships and the community and the humor and the irony and the, you know, there were so many things in it that I believe a society needs to be able to accommodate that level. I mean, the point is about what they're doing now in relation to so-called racism. What they're calling racism is what it basically is, an infantilization of the other. It's an infantilization of somebody on the basis that they have a darker skin than I have.
Taking their power away.
That means that I must handle them with kid gloves because they're very sensitive and maybe a little bit stupid is the implication. You know, that they won't understand my sense of humor if I make a joke about something that if I said it to you, you just go, you know, like Irish humor is very, very raw. And if I worked in offices and in different places through my life, in post offices and sorting offices, all these kind of things, goods office, and you know, you need to have a thick skin. But one of the things you learn in that is that actually there is no malice behind most of that. That is purely a way of communicating and, as it were, testing people and basically, you know, keeping the balance between them, defending yourself against attack and giving it back and so on. Why is it, who decided that we needed to get rid of this kind of communication out of so-called politeness, when the only consequence of it has been to increase the anxiety levels of most of the younger population?
I remember, and then we are going to talk in the 15 or so minutes we have left about the woman in the home, the care amendment. When my first gig was collecting glasses in a bar in Waterford. I would have been 14 at the time. And I was the butt of all the jokes because I was a new kid. So they sent me to another pub to ask for a long stand, John. And of course I did. I went and I asked for a long stand. And then the following night they said, Richie, go over to Peg's pub over there and get a can of compression, Richie, for the gas. A can of compression, right? So I did. And each time I got laughed at and Mickey taken grand. I read a story a couple of years ago about how somebody was fired for playing similar pranks on somebody. For bullying.
Yes.
There was no bullying. I wasn't being bullied. I was being tested. Is Richie any good? What sort of character does Richie have? Can he take a joke?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's no bullying in it.
Thereby relied upon in certain situations.
Exactly. Exactly.
To read them properly and understand and be sensitive then to people where sensitivity is necessary, but not all the time in relation to everybody, because a lot of the time it's not necessary.
No.
Because, you know, you can say more or less what you like to your friends in a jocose way, and they're not going to take offence. I have friends who speak to me entirely in the mode of abuse.
I have one or two of those as well. John Waters is our guest. You can't believe I fell for the long stand, though. I mean, that is horrendous. That'll stay with me to the day I die.
I was kind of nearly caught with the glass hammer.
The glass hammer for the ice. Yeah, go and get a glass hammer for the ice. Jesus. John Waters is our guest now. So the care amendment then. Most of my listeners who are Irish are voting Neil. They're going to say no to these. The care amendment is going to change the language and add a new clause saying the state recognises that the provision of care by members of a family to one another, by reasons of the bonds that exist among them, gives to society a support without which the common good cannot be achieved. They're putting in members of a family and taking out woman. And this is not good, say, women. And they're not all feminists. I've interviewed some of these women and they say this is not good at all. What say you on this other amendment?
Yeah, well, that care amendment is half of it, and it's the second half. But I just want to emphasize the first half, because what that's replacing is this thing, again, which these liars and creeps have been telling people, is a provision which says that the woman's place is in the home. That's what they're telling people.
Yeah.
Now, this is what it says. I'll read out the two short articles or paragraphs which say, in particular, the state recognises that by her life within the home, woman gives to the state a support without which the common good cannot be achieved. Two, the state shall therefore endeavour to ensure that mothers shall not be obliged by economic necessity to engage in labour to the neglect of their duties in the home. Now, what that is, Richie, is choice. What it extends to women is not a chain and manacles and handcuffs to be tied to the fridge or the deep freeze or the cooker. It's actually to give them the right to choose that if they want to be centermost in the lives of their children as they're growing up, they will have the right to do that. I want to read, because there's another article that these creeps and liars never read out, and it's Article 45, which is a couple of articles further down. It says, the state shall in particular direct its policy towards securing that the citizens, all of whom, men and women equally, have the right to an adequate means of livelihood, may through their occupations find the means of making reasonable provision for their domestic needs. Couldn't be clearer. So clearly, when you go back into Article 41 and you read the first two paragraphs that I've read out, you see this is now saying that, yes, you have the right to go. Women have the right to just as men go out. But if you choose to stay home, then the state will value that as well and protect your right and make sure you won't go wanting You won't be destitute having made that choice. That's what it means. And anything else is a lie.
So why did they want to change it then? Because you articulated that beautifully. So you have the clause that says if a woman wants to do this, she can't, she'll be protected. But in Article 45, it clearly defines it's a choice. So why did they want to change it?
Well, actually, you got it right in the right order the way you read it out, because that is the important one, the care thing that they're inserting, because that's what it's about, in my view. Or one of the central most things it's about. It's about, these things are always about several things. I mean, it's also about taking the word woman and mothers out of the Constitution, which is a trans agenda issue, for example. But the new care thing is this. One of the things that jumps out of you, you read it out before, I'll read it again. The state recognises that the provision of care by members of a family to one another by reason of the bonds that exist among them. Now, that harks back to the durable relations thing, remember, gives to society a support without which the common good cannot be achieved and shall strive to support such provision. What jumps out at me from that wording is that the state is more or less absolving itself from involvement in caring for people who need care in a family situation. Now, that would mean that, for example, there's a provision at the moment for, people going to homes. I'm not a big fan of homes for elderly people. I certainly hope I never end up in one. I don't think it's been a good turn in our society when there's so many of them. However, in the kind of culture that our society has now given itself, in the context where in order to keep a roof over your head, it's almost essential for the father and mother to be out working full time. These are all interlinked problems and things that don't need to be the way they are, but they are the way they are right now. And in a certain sense, we have to address that. But the point I'm making here is that this is clearly an attempt to absolve the state and to get the state off the hook in relation to helping families if they have elderly or disabled or ill people in their midst.
It certainly looks like that, to be honest, John. I'm looking for a way to be devil's advocate here, but I can't. I can see why you'd make that interpretation. And then
you add in the way that the demographic is going. You know, we're now heading for a big bulge in elderly people in Ireland. The Irish, more and more, the baby boomers are hitting pension age, they're over it. And the society is in a complete mess because of bad government over the years. I saw a thing last week where 100,000 Irish people applied last year for visas to Australia.
That's a massive,
100,000, Richie. Imagine that.
100,000, Wembley Stadium.
Yeah, and so that there's chaos here. We're getting rid of our own young people. They can't get homes. They can't get the means of having a roof over their heads. They can't get decent work. They're going off abroad. They're being replaced by foreigners who really have nothing to offer. But what you're going to end up with in situations like in care, if there are homes, that people who have no comprehension of the people they're treating or dealing with will be dealing with them. And that's a very uncomfortable prospect, I have to say, I mean, I insofar as I would ever feel, we used to talk one time about the county home, which is a great fear of people that they would be thrown into the county home, There was no nursing homes in that time. And that was a great fear. But even then, you go in there and there would be nurses or whatever, and they would be your own people. And you could have a chat with them. That's going as well, you see.
Do you know what a friend of mine once said about this? The aforementioned Jean Ann. Do you know what she said? I never heard it put so well. When I talked about this on the show about 3 years ago, about people from different parts of Africa and Asia, with different accents and sometimes not the best command of English, and how difficult that must be for the lady with dementia or the gentleman with hearing difficulties. My mate said to me, she said, familiarity breeds content. I thought it was beautifully put. That's exactly right. Why would you want somebody who's got nothing in common culturally with the elderly gentleman or the elderly lady, who doesn't have, the turn of phrase, who doesn't have the language? Why would you want to do it? And just before you come back in, I cannot say to our listeners, you've got to read this in the Daily Mail today. You can read it for free online. Cash for care jobs scandal exposed vulnerable UK patients being looked after by unqualified migrants as rogue fixers charge up to 20 grand for a 100% success rate job. And we're not talking about dozens, we're talking about hundreds. They're placing hundreds of people in care homes.
Yeah, and there is a case, I haven't gone into it in any much detail, but there is such a case in Ireland as well now in the headlines the last couple of weeks of a particular organisation run by a foreign gentleman himself, you know, which is in doing the same thing, and unvetted carers and so on and so on. This, of course, is bound to happen. You see, one of the things that goes with all this kind of politics, and we're back again to where we were at the beginning, Richie, talking about the extremism. When you have that kind of culture in politics, you have corruption, because there's no belief in anything, clearly. If you can lie and lie and lie and lie about your neighbour and accuse him of being a terrorist when all he's doing is trying to defend his community, then you don't have any conscience about anything. And the result is, in my experience, and I say this now, I see in all kinds of pockets of my life with different friends and different businesses and so on, that they're dealing with organisations which are semi-state or so, you know, that kind of thing. And they expect them to be rigorous and to be reliable. And what they do, what they find when they delve into it and actually look for help from these, that they're as crooked as the day is long on the 23rd of June and 21st of June. They talk about ethics. They talk about the law being important, that they have competition law and we have this kind of law. But there's no observance of it. Nor is there any sense that it ought to be observed. The sense is that it should be exploited, and that people who want to actually get in on the game and are prepared to play it properly, which is to say the odd little kickback or whatever, that's what's respected now in a culture such as we're creating.
We'll leave it there for today. I'll tell you why, right? There's a lot of comments have come in. There's one here from Rob. This is typical, right? I want to read this out. So I have a suggestion. I'll reach out to Matt, because it's been a long time since Matt was on the programme. And we'll arrange something where you and Matt can come on. I think we should do a special on this, because I've never seen such a reaction to what you said for most of the first part of this hour about your own experience and the difficulties faced by fathers when the relationship ends. And I'm reading messages here from women who are supporting this. This is Rob, right? I almost ended it all because I couldn't take the games my ex was playing with my kids. I haven't seen my youngest for 2 years, but my eldest is back in touch. So if anyone is feeling beat by an ex, you always have a chance with the kids when they are older, and you can explain things to them. Walking away is better than letting them push you to doing something stupid. That's from Rob. And I swear, why would I swear? They are legion, these messages. I mean, coming into it, because we're a live radio show. I think we should do something on this, John.
I agree. It is a quite extraordinary thing, and I'm not just saying it because I was the one who was there in Ireland. You know, as you say, Matt and other people have been involved as well in different ways. But it really shocks me that for all of that time, and I'm talking now, it's 30 years since I wrote a play and put it on in Kilkenny about this subject. 30 years I've been talking about this. And in all that time, I've got nothing but abuse from the authorities and from other media people and so on in general. And it staggers me that our Irish society has gone through this loop of progressivism, where they're supposedly, you know, reaching out to the minorities and the margins and righting wrongs and doing injustice and so on. And this one issue gets worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. Because every gain for a minority is a loss to fathers, one way or another, because they're the ones that the slack is taken from.
And as you said, there's scant, to put it mildly, coverage of it. Yet we talk about it and you speak about it. So I don't want to I wouldn't dream of patronising you, but so passionately and with so much emotion, because
I wrote hundreds of articles about this in the Irish Times from about 1996 through to 2014. And then I was driven out of it because I said, my position was, can we fix this before we create gay marriage? No.
No is the answer.
No.
Right, leave this with me, right? I'll reach out to Matt. I know you know Matt anyway, and we'll do a show. It's wonderful, because what we'll be able to do is we'll be able to take calls from people. So dads and even mums who've got something to say on it who want to ring in, we'll be able to take calls. We'll do a special on it because, I remember it was a regular enough thing for Matt to come on programmes with me when I was on the radio in Spain, back home, obviously, in Ireland as well. And I have been a bit surprised, to be honest, by the reaction to it. I mean, yeah, we're looking at dozens.
Matt's still out there. Matt's still out there. He's still at
he's
it.
Still, yeah.
Great man, you know. It's a really thankless job, you know, because all you're doing is basically putting your finger in dikes like every day and trying, you know, when you're trying to help one, every single man, every man who comes to you, you try to help them and advise them. And so, but it's a thankless and it's a job that really there's no comfort from, because it's very rarely does that man encounter decency in the system, never mind justice.
Somebody even said to me that you can't get a divorce here without a lawyer. They insist that you appoint counsel, whether you have the money or not. And with legal aid being attacked left, right and centre, particularly in this country, it's next to impossible to get free assistance.
Yeah, it's one of the most terrifying things of it, Richie, that, you know, because you don't know how long these things are going to go on. They could go on for years. And you find yourself in the hall of a court surrounded by senior counsel, junior counsel and a solicitor. And you're standing there for hours. And I said this before. I remember writing this back 20 years ago, how this feeling comes. And they're telling jokes, right, in the corridor. And you're standing there and you're laughing at the jokes. But then the thought occurs to you, I could have got Billy Connolly to come and do do a show in my front room.
Yeah.
For half of
if you wanted to laugh, yeah.
You know, like this is like a rudimentary thing to have an honour for the relationship, the flesh and blood relationship with your own child. You have to spend every cent you've ever earned in very many cases, and you still don't get it at the end.
You can read John Waters at johnwaters.substack.com. You've been listening to John, Irish journalist, writer, broadcaster. Profound that, mate. I wish I could send you all of these messages. There's so many of them.
Thanks to everybody. I'm very grateful because, you know, it's reassuring that people know about this, because it's one of the great secrets of our societies now.
And we've talked about the family courts often on this programme, but in the context of children being seized by the state without a very good reason, often from dads or mums, for very dubious things like future risk of emotional harm.
That's
imagine
right.
That.
Well, that's a big one as well, Richie, and I've dealt with that over the years as well, and I actually dealt with families coming from the UK where the social services are absolutely savage. Coming to Ireland, thinking that because of our constitution, they might have a better chance of being saved and being treated well. Of course, the authorities there would just grab the children and send them back.
And there's a big scandal developing in Ireland at the moment with TUSLA, which is the organisation charged with protecting children, isn't there? There's a big scandal emerging, which we can talk about on a future show. Leave Matt with me. I'll sort all that out. And in the next couple of weeks, let's do a show on this. We've got to do a follow-up on it. So, and just once again, thanks for your time today. It's always a pleasure chatting with you, John. Thank you.
Pleasure. Likewise, Richie. Nice to talk to you.
My pleasure. Bye. Thanks, John. John Waters, Irish journalist, writer, author, broadcaster, top man. JohnWaters.substack.com is where you'll read John. I will, of course, put the links to where you can find him on the podcast notes, because I'll be doing the podcast soon. Hang on a second there. Yeah, I'm back. I was doing that thing. I won't tell you what I was doing. At one ear on, one ear off with the headphones. A bit discombobulated there for a minute. Anyway, right, so we're back in the room. Thanks again to John. Thank you. Look, a lot of messages came in there during that conversation, and one or two of you are getting a little bit antsy because I didn't read your comments out. I didn't want to interrupt John to be doing that. I'm going to save these comments. What we'll do is we'll do a show on this. And there are some women getting in touch saying, look, there's another side to this as well. Damn right there is. And that will be reflected in any programme that we do about it. We'll do a 2-hour special. And I'll open the phone lines. We'll get Matt O'Connor on from Fathers for Justice. We'll get John on. And then you can come on and put comments, points, whatever it is you want to say. If you want to take an opposing point of view, of course, room will be made for you to do that. Look, that's it. As I said, I'm back with you tomorrow at 4 o'clock UK time with Fred and Richard from Right Said Fred. But before that, the Papers podcast will be online tomorrow morning, as usual, sometime around about 7 a.m. or at least sometime before 7:30. This is a lovely song by Keith Urban, and it's called Song for Dad. I think it's fairly appropriate we close out the show with this. And once again, thanks to my friend John Waters. And I'll see you tomorrow. Bye now.
Mm-hmm.